I am Wallace, and I'm an alcoholic. And I really appreciate those kind remarks. It's good to be here tonight. Always good to be in an AA meeting. I appreciate Darrell asking me back in February, would I come out and share with you folks? And I can tell you that from what I have seen here already, AA is alive and well in this community. And it's a real joy and a pleasure to be here at the specific convention. I was told by my sponsor, Tom I, several weeks ago that this would be a joyous occasion. And already it's been a great event for me. And I'm probably very fortunate in that I may be the only one here tonight that will have 27 hours of sobriety today. Right now, it's 25 minutes to 11 at home. And it's my bedtime. I got up at 4 o'clock this morning, and I can't sleep on a plane. It was very, very boring, and that's the way I like those flights to be. I don't want anything exciting going on. But it is good to be here. I may be a little bit tired, but when I get over this, I'll feel a lot better. And I do appreciate the warmth, hospitality I felt already. And I'm sure I'll leave here tonight with some new friends. And I believe that I will grow a little bit in the AA way of life. My sobriety date is February 16th, 1964. And you can look at me and tell I've been somewhere for a long time. But it is good to be here. I am a member in good standing of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And I understand that my sponsor was out here a couple of weeks ago, and I hope he didn't mess up you people too badly. But it's always a joy and a privilege to be invited any place. And really and truly, this is the first time that I've ever been invited to come this far and speak to a home group. I've been in many, many conventions all over the nation, but never to a home group. And it's a real honor and a privilege to be here, and thank you for having me. I know that I am an alcoholic, and I know that I have been one since I was around 20 years old, but I had all of the tendencies for becoming an alcoholic when I was growing up. I grew up and was born and raised in a family of cotton mill workers in Roxboro, North Carolina. Six boys and six girls in the family. Mom and Dad finally found out what was causing it, and they quit. I'm the baby boy, and I'm very much like the earlier speaker in that I never felt like I fit in any place. I didn't feel like I fit in at home. I felt inferior, less than. I kept on waiting for them to tell me that I was adopted, but they never did. And I've always been skinny. I was skinny as a kid, and I'm still skinny. If I took my coat off and shirt and drank a Coca-Cola, I'd probably look like a thermometer up here. As a skinny kid, there was a joke going around my hometown that I had a sister so skinny that she swallowed an olive and two men left town. Now, I'm not quite that skinny, but I am skinny, and I've always felt bad about it. I hated to put on a bathing suit. I hated to be out in public in any way that a lot of my body was exposed. I never have been a Herculean person. I could not participate in sports the way that some boys did. I didn't like football. I was chicken. When they'd start to tackle me, I'd hit the ground. I'd stumble. I didn't like getting hit. I liked baseball and other sports. I played golf real well from the time I was 9 years old. on up until today. I'm a pretty good golfer today. And growing up in Roxburgh, North Carolina, and feeling bad about myself and not getting an education, I felt really hurt me. And as a kid working hard in the fields when we started farming from the time I was 5 years old up until I was 16, we had to work before school, we had to work after school, and I'd miss a lot of school in the spring and in the fall of the year. And I had a preacher brother that I didn't like. I know that from the very beginning of my childhood, I was spiritually sick. Mom and Dad would go to church. My sisters and brothers would go to church. And I never felt in church the way they acted as they felt. And I just didn't like it. I would much rather be outside. And later on, and this was a long, long time ago, my older brother was 21 years old when he left home with a seventh grade education. He went down to South Carolina, got into middle school down there, went to high school, got a college degree, and later on became a doctor of divinity. I never did like that guy. He would come home and Mom would cook up chicken and vegetables and have the biggest meal you ever seen in your life for him. And he would pray and say grace. And by golly, by the time he got through saying grace, the prayer would be so long the food would be cold. And he'd pray before he went to bed, and he'd pray in the morning. And from the time I was 6 years old on up until I was 14, he'd give me man-to-man talks. And he could always carry me down behind the barn as a small kid, 6, 8, 12, 14 years old, and talk to me about what I should and should not do. And I didn't know what he was talking about because he was using some of those long words, some courses I'd never heard of. And if he had used four-letter words, I would have probably understood. But when I was 14 years old, he had me down behind that barn and telling me what I should and should not do. And it seemed he always changed his voice when he talked to me. He said, "Wallace, if you ever drank that white whiskey like your father did, if you ever run with those naughty girls, or you ever play with yourself, you're going to hell." And I'm 14 years old down behind that barn with him that Sunday afternoon before he's going back to South Carolina. And I got to thinking, I ain't never touched no white liquor. I ain't never had a chance to be with a naughty girl. But heck, I'm already in trouble. And I made up my mind he'd never get me behind that barn again, and he didn't. I dropped out of school when I was 16 years old because we quit farming. I wanted an automobile. My father would not let me drive his car. He said, "If you get an automobile, if you drive, you'll buy your own car." He didn't force me to go back to high school. I already knew more than he did. I was very intelligent, I thought. And I went to work in cotton mill, and at the age of 17, I got that car, and for the first time, I became popular. Older boys began running around with me on weekends, and those older boys were drinking beer, and it wasn't long before I was sipping a little bill with them, and I did that for 2 years. And during that 2 years, I never once got high. I never once felt the effects of that beer because I poured out most of mine. We'd be at a ball game, a drag race or something, and when they were not looking, I'd pour that beer out on the ground where they wouldn't see that I was drinking so little. I didn't like it. I knew why Budweiser had all those Clydesdale horses around. That's what it looked like to me. And I thought maybe that's what it tasted like. In 1953, I was 19 years old. The Korean War was in progress, and I was drafted. I went off to Fort Jackson, South Carolina for basic training, and about 12 weeks later, I was transferred to Fort Lee, Virginia for additional schooling there. And in November of 1953, I went back to Roxborough on a weekend pass. That particular Saturday night, I went out to a round and square dance that I had been to several times before. And I was standing out at that dance that night with a flat top haircut about like it is tonight, except it was a lot thicker and a different color. Had on that Army OD uniform, and I had some little pins up on the shoulders to make it look better. I also had on all the medals I'd earned that afternoon at the PX. And I'm standing there at the heater doing what I always did out in public. I'm watching other people have a good time. Laugh, talk, dance, be with the girls, just have a ball. And I wanted so much to do that, and I couldn't, because I felt so inferior, less than, timid, shy, backwards, uneducated country. That's just the way I felt. And I watched those people have a good time. And then I'm looking over toward the door. The concession stand is over in the right-hand corner, and the door is there. And I saw these two humongous protrusions come in that door. And they were attached to a beautiful woman. And I mean, they came in the door a long time before she did. And she started walking across that floor, and everything was just a bouncing in unison. And she came straight to that heater where I was with my medals on. And she started talking to me, and I was embarrassed. I was restless, ill at ease, and discontent. And as she was talking to me, the buddies that I had come out there with were looking over there at me and giggling, and some other people were looking at that way toward us, whispering some things, and I knew they were talking about me, and I was wondering what was really going on. But I had recognized this woman when she walked across the floor, even though I had never seen her before in my life. I recognized her because of some stories I'd heard when I was in pool rooms and service stations and beer joints. I had heard some stories about her that would curl your hair. And when she was over there talking to me, I was nervous, embarrassed. And it wasn't long that she made a suggestion that I escort her out to her car. And this would be a good way to escape. And also, it might be my patriotic duty, since I'm right out of basic training, it might be some wolves in the parking lot. I go with her out to the car in that well-lit parking lot. And it was a cold November night, and she got in an old Chevrolet and started it up. She started the radio up, put it on some good country and western music, and then had to reach way over there in front of my knees to get to that heater button to turn it on to get some heat going. And while she was over there, she began pecking on my ear and my neck and saying some things to me, trying to get some heat going somewhere else. And I really got restless, ill at ease, and discontent. And she sat over there a little bit and started whispering some more things and nudging up against me. And I really got nervous and shook up. And finally, she saw that I was backward in country, and she reached up under the seat of her car and pulled out a pint of white moonshine whiskey and two cups, and she poured out two cups of whiskey, and she stuck that whiskey out in front of me, one cup in each hand. And then these things that my brother had told me began to crop into my head, and this little battle began to start. Should I or should I not? I'll go to hell if I get involved in this. And I think about the things I'd heard about her when I was in the pool rooms and service stations. And I look at that whiskey, and I look at her, and look at them. And I thought a little bit more, and I look back over there at them, and them told me to take a drink. And I took a drink. And shortly thereafter, we had another drink. And about 30 to 35 minutes we sat in that car that night, we had several drinks of that white moonshine whiskey. And I can tell you, when I got in that car that night, I was country, uneducated, backward, shy, timid, But something began to change about me that night as I sat in that car. All of the hard farm work I had done, all of the rigorous Army basic training I had had, never produced in me the feeling that slowly began to evolve in me and just go all over my body. I began to get articulate. I became very knowledgeable. My teeth straightened out. My hair got curly. My muscles began to swell up, all of them. And I knew everything was going to be all right. We sat in that car, and it wasn't too long as a result of my becoming a little bit aggressive in that well-lit parking lot that she suggested we go in a dance. We went in a dance, and that fiddle and guitar and banjo struck up a tune, and she grabbed me by the hand on the floor. We went, and I circled that room about twice. I could do-si-do, promenade, lemonade, whatever they was doing, I could do it. And people were looking at us and laughing. The men were very, very envious. And I was having a ball. She had on my Ike jacket, but she didn't have it buttoned up. It was stuck out just like that. I had a ball. We even done a bunny hop that night. They had to calm me down because that just come natural to me. I got carried away. And I got to quit that story right there. I can't go into all the details. But about 2:30 Sunday morning, all of the fireworks are over. I'm back at home, upstairs in the bed I'd slept in for years prior to going to service. And I'm laying there in bed, and I'm fighting off sleep. I don't want to ever go to sleep again. I just want to lay there and relive Saturday night over and over again, thinking about every marvelous thing that had happened. How I had grown up, how I had become a man, thinking about the mountains I had climbed, the valleys I had crossed, thinking about how my preacher brother and mom and dad had lied to me like dogs, telling me that booze was something that would send me to hell and I had been in heaven on Saturday night, and I knew that the next weekend I would be back in that kind of environment, trying to do everything over again. And the following Friday night when I went on past from Fort Lee, Virginia, I bought my first pint of whiskey before I got home. And I began to have a lot of good times drinking and having a ball and doing those things that I had learned how to do that Saturday night. In fact, it was 6 weeks before the trouble started. 6 weeks later, I got drunk, drank some vodka with some guys, and I had never drunk vodka before. And that was late Sunday afternoon, and I had come to on the jailhouse floor in Roxboro on a Monday morning. I was supposed to have been back at Fort Lee, Virginia. That was the first time my father cried about my actions, the first time I had gotten caught for drunken driving, the first time I was in trouble with the military authorities, first time I lost my driver's license, the first time I was in a court system. A lot of firsts took place as a result of that weekend. And I can tell you that over the next 10 years, that kind of activity continued, and I was caught for more than 14 times for driving under the influence and driving after license revoked, resisting arrest, striking police officers, and all that sort of stuff. I got out of the Army after the first 2 years, but I went back in 18 months later. I went back in because, not because I was patriotic, but because I had some more driving charges that the prosecuting attorney would drop in the event I went back on active duty. I also had a new wife, and I didn't want a new wife. I was to be a father, and I didn't want to be a father. But it was a gentlemanly thing to do in those days to get married when something happened. And nowadays we hear about children in the back seat can cause accidents. And I can tell you from self-experience that accidents in the back seat can cause children. We got married, and I was back on active duty in 9 days. Some 3 months later, I'm en route to Korea, and I made up my mind on the ship looking back over my life. I'm tired of paying court fines, bail bondsmen, lawyers, tired of owing mom and dad money, tired of all this trouble. Drinking's got to be something to do with this. And I made up my mind in Korea I would not drink. 5 months in Korea, there was no drinking. I went to school at night. I practiced military courtesy. I did a good job. I was Soldier of the Month 5 consecutive times, Battalion Soldier of the Month 3. I had gone back in through the National Guard with the rank of corporal. In Korea, they put me before the promotion board after 5.5 months, and I was promoted to sergeant. That Saturday afternoon, I went down to the NCO club to buy my friends some drinks, and I had not drunk anything in 5.5 months. And as I sat in the club with those guys, watching them drink and dance with the Korean girls, my illness that I had, which I did not know at the time was an illness, began to talk to me and convinced me that I needed to socialize with those guys a little bit and have a few drinks. And I made the mistake of doing that. And they made a mistake, too, and a couple of hours later when they threw me out of that place head first through the screen door because I had become drunk and disorderly. I don't recall getting back to the barracks that night. I remember Sunday morning that I reached over on the dresser and I got a fifth of whiskey that was sitting there and I began to drink. I did the same thing on Monday, knowing I was going on duty. And it wasn't long before I was having lots of trouble in Korea. It was not long before I met a board again, and this time I was demoted from sergeant to corporal. And some 18 months later, I was very fortunate to make it back to the States with the rank of corporal, just as I had left when I was en route to Korea. At Fort Lee, I got a 30-day leave. I came home. I met my little daughter for the first time, and Mom and Dad agreed to furnish a 5-room apartment for my wife and I was to come home and be a husband on weekends and be a father to that little girl. They loved that little girl dearly. And I tried to do that for 2 or 3 weeks. And I couldn't keep up my end of the deal because I'd start drinking on weekends and I'd end up getting drunk and in trouble. And that was in October when we furnished that apartment. In January of 59, I walked out of that apartment one Sunday night and I went down to the highway hitchhiking back to Fort Lee, Virginia. And when that truck driver stopped to pick me up, he asked me when I got in the truck, said, "Soldier, why are you crying?" And I couldn't tell him I was walking out on a little girl I loved dearly. I couldn't tell him I was walking out on a wife I didn't love. I couldn't tell him I was living to drink and drinking to live. Couldn't tell him that I couldn't pay phone bills and light bills and buy groceries. I was running from life. And I got back at Fort Lee and began to have problems there, which extended over the next year, year and a quarter or so forth. And during that next year, I got in trouble at Fort Lee a lot of times. I got caught in Richmond, Virginia for drunken driving and hit and run. I appealed that case from low court into high court, and before I could be tried on it, I was caught in Colonial Heights, Virginia on 7 more driving charges. And then it seems that the company commander was getting a lot of complaints about my activities. Guys were telling the company commander and the first sergeant that I was coming into the dorm room at night, slamming wall locker doors and falling over foot lockers. The mess sergeant was saying that I was coming into the mess hall and vomiting in the mess hall in the morning. And those guys were complaining. They were real sissies. They were not at all like the brave soldiers we have serving in Iraq today. I could go into the mess hall and vomit just a little small puddle and they'd get all upset. They couldn't stand it. And they'd take me to the company commander. And he was getting fed up with it. The prosecuting attorney called the company commander and told him that in the event that when I was tried on those charges, then I would probably get some jail time. The company commander took matters into his own hands then, and he took my record for the past 2 years and put it before a board of 12 officers. And every one of those officers looked at the events that had been going on in my life, and every one of them declared that I had become alcoholically unfit for military service, and they booted me out with an undesirable discharge. I no longer looked like the guy that had been Soldier of the Month, Battalion Soldier of the Month, the guy that had worn out over 1,300 other people for the rank of sergeant. I didn't look like that anymore. When I walked around that company area into the recreational area where they shot pool and played ping pong and read magazines, I absolutely could not hold my head up and look at those guys. I had to look down at the floor. I was so ashamed, so humiliated about my actions, my appearance, the way that I looked, the way that I was drinking, and my total inability to stop. The company commander had been sending me to a chaplain for counseling, and it didn't do any good. He sent me for 6 to 7 weeks, and the chaplain recommended that I see a psychiatrist. And again, for about 2 months, a psychiatrist counseled with me, and it didn't do any good. I'd still get drunk every night when I left his office. The company commander was really fed, and they, when they booted me, I'm sure he was relieved. And he was, the prosecuting attorney was absolutely right. The next day, after I got booted from service, I went to court, and that judge gave me a 90-day jail sentence and fine of $575, the cost of court. I pulled 57 days of that jail sentence in Cedar Jail in Petersburg, Virginia. I had divorced wife number one by then, and I had a girlfriend. And every alcoholic ought to have one girlfriend like that. She was only 19 or 20 years older than I, and she was out in the parking lot that morning with her grandchildren in that old dilapidated automobile. And when she paid that fine and I walked out of jail out to the car where she was, she saw me coming apparently by looking in the mirror, and she got out of the car and ran around to the trunk and met me. And I said, "Ruth, I'll never go to another jail as long as I live." And she says, "Let's drink to it." Well, I hadn't seen her drink in 57 days, and she handed me a brand new pint. I broke a seal on it. I took two or three big swigs on that and toasted that old Petersburg City Jail. I handed it to her. She spit her snuff out, and she took a pull on it. The next morning, Ruth was up there again to get me out. Her brother-in-law and sister had come down from D.C., Washington, D.C., to celebrate Ruth's lover getting out of jail. Matt got caught for drunken driving that night, and they locked me up because I was passed out in the back seat. I couldn't even pass out without getting in trouble. And I ran from one job to another in Virginia, lived up there with her. Finally went back home one day when Ruth went to work. She went to work at the cigarette factory, and I went into the back room there to the clothes hamper and got the cleanest dirty clothes that I had, and I hit US-1 hitchhiking back home to Mom and Dad. They wanted me to come home, and I was really appreciative of the invitation. And I moved in with Mom and Dad, and they said, "No drinking. The first time you drink, you're out of here." And I did want to get my life straightened out, and I was going to really and truly try, and I did. And for the next 5.5 months, again, this period of dryness, I worked in the mill at night from 11 o'clock to 7 in the morning. I'd stay around my father's house. I'd spend a lot of time down in his store. And they introduced me to a Baptist Sunday school teacher that was 8 years older than I. And after that 5.5 months of dryness, she was thoroughly convinced she had me saved and I'd be able to tiptoe through the tulips forevermore with her. So she asked me to marry her. We got married. 3 weeks later, we went to a dance. And Baptists don't normally dance around home, but Sue was an exception. She loved to dance. The Baptists around home won't dance, or they won't even have sex standing up because they're afraid somebody will think they're dancing. But Sue was different. She loved to dance. And I was at that dance that night, and I was sober, and I had 9 left feet. When she wanted to do-si, I wanted to do. When she wanted to promenade, I wanted to lemonade. I couldn't do it. The music just didn't sound right. A guy that worked in the mill with me handed me a glass of old granddad when she was in the powder room. And when she got back, I was ready to dance. And I did dance with her for a couple of numbers, but when the dance was over that night, they had to wake me up at the back of the room. I had passed out at her table. She went out the door crying that night, totally embarrassed about my actions. And I went out the door behind her cursing and vomiting. And raising Cain, and I put her through an awful lot of hell for the next year. And many, many times during the summer and fall and winter of 1962, I tried to quit drinking again. I could not. I tried going with her to church again. And those little old ladies would look over those glasses at me, and I'd feel so humiliated and so ashamed because I knew that they could smell whiskey on my breath, and there would be nicks and cuts on my face where I'd tried to shave that morning. And I was just in bad shape, and I was embarrassed. And I was so out of place. And I'd go right back to drinking time I got home. Not once during that period of being married to Sue did I get caught for drunken driving. Not once. I had learned my lesson about that, but I did get called for drunken walking many times. I got arrested that way. And they take me to jail. Sometimes they take me home. And it didn't make any difference to me sometimes which way I went, because either way I went, I was going to catch hell anyway, I knew. And sometimes I deliberately agitate those deputies, and they whip up on my head and then take me to jail. I was insane and didn't know what to do about it. And their solutions would not work in my life. After Christmas of 1963, I had not been sober very much. The third week in January of 63, I had started drinking on a Friday. We got off work at 2 o'clock. I don't recall getting home Friday night. I don't recall getting home Saturday night or Sunday night. The only memories I have of that weekend are a few memories on Saturday morning of a sister, my baby sister, being over at the house, and her and my wife having prayer with me, and I made fun of them. Monday morning, after that 4 days and 3 nights of complete blacked out drunken insanity, my wife was shaking me at 5:30 on Monday morning, asking me was I going to work, and I said yes. And I got up off my bed and turned to the right to go into the bathroom. And when I turned to the right, my elbow hit something on the pillow. And I raised up the pillow. I didn't know what it was because I had heard a clanging noise. And it was 2 pints of white moonshine whiskey on that pillow that I apparently put under that pillow Sunday night. And I sat down on the side of that bed and began to drink. And a few minutes later, wife number 2 came in the room and saw what was going on. And then she confronted me again with more authority than she had used the entire year. And this time I knew she meant business from what she was saying. And I can tell you, she did not sound like a Baptist Sunday school teacher that morning. She began to tell me basically that I was a sorry, no good, useless, low down drunk, no good to my daughter, to my family, or to anyone else. And that when she got home from work that afternoon, she wanted me out of her heart and out of her life forever. and she went on to work. And apparently late that morning, I did leave home and went to the bootleg beer joint nearby and called a taxi and went to town. And what I'm telling you now is from hearsay or what I had to read about in the paper. And I'm not going to take step five up here tonight. But I did go to town that afternoon. I heard a sheriff sometime later testify that he had looked out his window that afternoon at 4 o'clock. He saw me on the street drunk, and he was coming out to arrest me. But the telephone rang, and that he talked on the phone for about a minute, and he came back to the door to see where I was, and he didn't see me. He figured the police had me or would have me in a few minutes, and he forgot about it. And, folks, I wished a million times that he had arrested me that Monday afternoon, because sometimes within the next couple of hours is when offenses were committed that brought about my arrest the next morning. And I was placed in jail and no bond was allowed. And that was January 21st of 63. And on February the 11th, 3 weeks later, I stood in Superior Court unable to defend myself, even though the family had hired a lawyer to defend me. There was no defense because I had been in a blackout almost constantly for 4 days and three nights, and I had no defense. And he said, we'll stand mute and we'll listen to the evidence and have to suffer the consequences. The sheriff presented the evidence. The judge listened. And then he says, young man, stand up. And when I stood up, the lawyer had to help me to my feet. And he says, for the offenses committed, I hereby sentence you to a period of 40 years and then natural life at the expiration of State Penitentiary in Raleigh. Take him out of here, sure. And it was 2 days later, I was handcuffed and shackled between two other people and taken into the walls of Central Prison in Raleigh. Within a few days, I stood before a classification committee, and the associate warden looked at me and looked at my sentence, and he says, if you have any hope or any desire to get out of here ever again, you're going to have to be a good boy. And I knew by having been in there several days that I was going to be a good boy, that I didn't like that place, and I was going to stay straight so that one day I would be able to get out. But my good intentions went by the wayside within 3 weeks when some guys that I worked with introduced me to some other things that were being smuggled into the prison system by free people who wanted to make additional money. There was also little bottles of alcohol being smuggled out of the hospital. And I began to get those bottles of alcohol, and I began to get drunk, and I began to get in trouble. And I got fired while I was there in prison after being there for 4 months. But you can bet your butt they didn't send me home. I was sent to work in the print shop then. And that was in June of 63. Also in June of 63, I attended a crazy meeting they had there called Alcoholics Anonymous. Also in June of 63, back home, a guy had been waiting for wife number two when she got home from work one morning. He was in the bedroom waiting on her, and he robbed her, assaulted her, kidnapped her, and it took them several days to get word to me. And I used that excuse to go to the doctor to tell him I was nervous and upset, and he wrote out a prescription for some things that would help settle my nerves. And that way I could legally walk the yard drunk, and they couldn't lock me up for being drunk. And I used that excuse for as long as I could. I attended that AA meeting for the next 8 months and sat in the back of the room, and not once did I participate in any way. I didn't take any pamphlets out. I didn't read the big book, wasn't introduced to the big book, didn't help make coffee, didn't help set up. I sat in the back of the room. I saw three people come in. Now and then they'd hug an inmate. Now and then they'd hug each other. They'd talk about love, and I knew it was love already there because it was two guys on the back row holding hands every Thursday night, and I didn't want no part of it. I hadn't hit bottom, but on February 16, 1964, I had been writing a letter home that Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and I'd have these periods when I would swear off, I'm going to get myself straight. I'm not going to do any of that mess anymore. I'm not going to drink any more of that alcohol. But my good intentions within the prison unit went by the wayside just as they had in the community, and I go right back to doing. But that Sunday afternoon in the library, I was writing a letter to my precious mom, always telling her how sorry I was for the shame and humiliation and all of the heartbreak I brought upon the family. And I was writing that letter, and I had about 2 pages of it written. And a guy came in that was my friend, a so-called friend. He gave me a couple of things, and I took them. And within 10 to 15 minutes' time, completing that letter to my precious mom was no longer important. I tore it up, threw it in the trash can, and I went out behind the chapel where I had some dollars, some round plastic, looks like play money, dollars hid in the dirt. And I dug them up, went to the bootlegger, and got drunk. And I came to that night of February 16th, 1964, in my cell, way up on the fourth floor, a two-man cell, and my buddy had been in the hospital several days with the virus. I was in that cell block alone that night, and I came to after 8 o'clock, and I took a look at where I was in life. With a sentence of natural life in 40, no way will I ever get out. I had nothing to look forward to. My past was too despicable. It had been too full of sickness and heartbreak and humiliation and shame that I brought upon the family. I couldn't look at that, and I couldn't tolerate the present. The only thing that made sense was suicide. And I made up my mind that night, knowing that the door would slide open at 9 o'clock. I can go out onto that catwalk and go over that railing head first, 40 feet to the concrete below, and end my wretched existence. It'll be over. And I was fully committed to doing that after I took everything I had under the pillow and drank that last bottle of alcohol. And I stood at that door waiting, knowing that that guard is going to pull that lever and that door is going to slide open for that whole row of cell block doors that night at 9 o'clock. And you can call it whatever you want to. You can call it God, you can call it sickness, you can call it blackout or whatever. I stood at that door waiting, and sometime around 9:30 or 9:40 that night, well past 9 o'clock, the door had opened and closed, and there was a row of vomit from that door to the commode, and my head was in the commode, and I was crying and choking and gasping for breath, and I passed out on the commode again, and I came to sometime later, and crawled to my bed and got into bed. And the next morning when I went out, the guys in the cell block on the right and on the left said, "What was going on in there last night?" I says, "What are you talking about?" They said that last night you cried out loud enough for everybody on this cell block row to hear you. You said, "God, if you'll help me get back to AA, I'll try." I no more remember saying that than you do. I don't remember saying that. But those guys had no reason whatsoever to fabricate that story. And I can tell you that I suffered during that next several days. And on Thursday night, I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at Central Prison, knowing precisely why I was there, knowing that I had to do something else. And as that girl earlier talked about tonight, that degree of desperation, I know that God in His infinite mercy gave me a gift that night that I still have with me today. That was a gift of desperation. Because when I walked in that Thursday night meeting at Central Prison AA group, I moved from the back of the room up to the left of the podium, just like you are sitting tonight. And I got active in that group. Within 2 weeks, Tom Ivester, the guy that y'all had up here a couple of weeks ago, my sponsor, gave me a copy of the big book and told me what I needed to do with that book. And I got active in that group. And I have never met another inmate that was as active in Alcoholics Anonymous as I was during the entire time that I stayed in. And over the next several years, a total of 18 years, 1 month, 26 days, and 2 hours, I was active in 3 different facilities. The last years of my incarceration was spent at the Sanford Correctional Center, where I was allowed to go on work release in 1973. And when I was transferred to the Sanford Correctional Center, wife number 2 came to see me. She had been to a couple of AA meetings that I had been allowed to attend, and to a couple of them that I had spoken at down in the Raleigh area before I was transferred to Sanford. And she didn't like AA. And she was still involved in her church. And she told me, she says, it looks like it you'll be getting out in a few years. And when you get out, you're going to have to give up that AA cult. You can come home and stay with me, and we'll tiptoe through the tulips and go to church and be happy forevermore, since that AA thing is of the devil. I said, Sue, you may be jealous of Alcoholics Anonymous because AA has done something for me that you, my family, nobody else has ever been able to do. It's given me a way of life whereby I can walk with dignity and respect. And if you think that AA is of the devil, you can go to the devil. You can divorce me, and if you don't divorce me, I'll divorce you. 2 years later, I divorced her because she would not divorce me. I was working during the week with the phone company and was able to save some money. I paid room and board to the prison department for several years, but I was working for the phone company. And they gave me permission to buy an acre of land. I bought that land, and a sister moved a mobile home down from Roxburgh, and I was able to go out on weekends and visit with that sister. And while I was out with that sister on a weekend, I went with her to church, and I met a little lady one Sunday at church there. Well, she walked up to me and introduced herself, and 3 years later, after she had come by the house to see my sister an awful lot and talk to me some, the Department of Correction gave us permission to get married. She married me 3 years before I got out of prison. She had confidence in me. She had confidence in Alcoholics Anonymous. She knew my story. She had heard it. And that little lady and I will celebrate 28 years come May 26th. The last year that I was in prison, the Department of Correction gave me permission to build a home. And I built that home before I got out. I had it built. And then a male member of Al-Anon went to bat for me. And he got a lot of people to write letters, and over 500 letters from bankers, lawyers, sheriff's department, the phone company people, and other people who knew me there in Sanford where I was working with the phone company during the week. Over 500 letters went into the governor's office telling the governor Hunt at that time that Lee County would be proud to have Wallace living in their county as a member of their community, that he was deserving of a time cut. Governor Hunt believed those people and commuted all that time down to 35 years, whereby I was paroled in 1981. 5 years later, I came home from work one day. And I stopped at the mailbox. My wife had already come home from work from J.C. Penney office, and she was at the door at the carport. And I stopped at the mailbox and got the letter and went on up the road. And when I got out of the car, behind her car, I opened the letter and began to read it. And I started crying, and Bobby Jean says, what are you crying about? I said, I was just reading this letter from the parole board. And basically what it was saying was, "Mr. Bryant, congratulations. You have completed your obligation to the state of North Carolina. You've done it with dignity and respect. You are now a citizen of the state of North Carolina again. You are a free man." And I said, "Baba Jean, this is a nice letter, but there's one thing wrong with that letter." She said, "What is that?" I said, "This letter states that I'm a free man." I told her, I says, "I have been a free man since 1966, 2 years after I got in AA, 2 years after I took step 5 with the Presbyterian minister, 2 years after I had worked the other steps of the program and I had experienced that psychic change in my life. And the desire to drink that I had had during those first 2 years in prison was taken away from me after the program of Alcoholics Anonymous went from my head to my heart, and I began to live by the principles and teachings. And that program is still dwelling within my heart and soul and mind today. That little mom that came to visit me during the first couple of years, she was ever mindful of the fact that something was going on in my life. When she saw me during that first year that I was in prison, and my pupils would be real small, the next week they'd be real big. Sometimes my speech would be slurred. But Mom saw a change take place in me. In 1971, an AA member signed me out and took me to her bedside in Roxburgh, North Carolina, where Mom was laying, dying of cancer. And when I walked into her hospital room that night, she was laying there weighing about 65 pounds. I got down on my knees beside her bed and took her little bony hand in mine. And I says, "Mom, why are you crying? Are you crying about me?" She says, "No, Wallace," says, "I'm not crying about you." Says, "I don't cry about you anymore. You're going to be all right. But," says, "one of your other brothers can't be here tonight. He's drunk, and he knows I'm dying." And when I got ready to leave that room that night, she looked up at me and she says, "Will you do me a favor? And you know a guy in prison. Well, tell his dying mother he'll make any kind of promise to her." She says, "Will you do me a favor?" And I says, "Yeah, Mom, what is it?" She says, "Will you always stay in that AA thing?" And I says, "Yeah, Mom, I will." And that was February 14th of 1971. On a Wednesday night, Mom died 2 nights later. And here it is, 2007. And Mom's baby boy, Wallace, is still standing tall in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you, that it's not because of the promise I made to Mama. It's not because of that at all. It's because every promise on page 83 and 84 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, has been a reality in my life for many, many, many years. The program of recovery I have today and practice and live by today is a program of recovery I found it behind the walls of Central Prison and carried into the other institutions. It enabled me to walk out into the free community and share what a loving God and you people have brought into the prison facility and given me. And that's why I'm in prison facilities every Wednesday night of every month. I go into the Marsham Correctional Center with Tom the first 2 Wednesday nights. The third Wednesday night, I'm in Central Prison, my old home group in Raleigh. The fourth Wednesday night, I'm at the Sanford Correctional Center, a group that Tom and I started in 1971 at the Sanford Correctional Center when he was a superintendent or warden of that institution, and I was transferred up there. See, Tom and I run that place. He was a superintendent, and I run a lawnmower, the buffer, the clothes house, those things. We run that place. But I'm grateful that the man took an interest in me. He's been my counselor down through the years. I couldn't get him to be a sponsor when I was an inmate. You don't want resentments between other inmates and yourself when you're in a prison facility. I couldn't ask Tom to be my sponsor. He was my counselor. And when I took step five with Reverend John, I asked him that night to be my sponsor, and he was my sponsor up until 17 years ago. He died of cancer. 2 weeks before he died of cancer, him and I selected who my next sponsor would be. It was Tom. Tom has been a great hero model in my life, a guy that I can never, ever emulate, a guy who's had the audacity to get on me when I needed getting on. He's a guy that's had the courage to encourage me when he knows that I'm doing what I should be doing. And I know that as a direct result, there's many stories I could tell whereby he has been vitally important in my life, especially during the riot in 1968 at Central Prison, when seven people were killed and I was almost killed, even though I had nothing to do with it. There's a lot of things I could share with you, but I don't have time tonight. But I am grateful to share with you that I am a happy, sober, decent, respectable member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe with all my heart that extending the hand of AA, reaching out, trying to be of maximum service to God and to those about us is real, real important so far as staying sober is concerned. I know that I'm not cured of alcoholism. What I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I maintain that by trying to reach out and help those that are sponsored and help those in the correctional units and that newcomer that walks in the door. If I keep on doing this, I believe that I can stay sober another day. I love you, folks.